This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Y'all, this is a special Zone 7. We are going to talk to somebody that the heroes look up to. You don't have to look any further than the National Law Enforcement Hall of Fame that honors officers that have gone above and beyond the call of duty. And tonight, we have Tom Smith. He is a part of my Zone 7. He is a part of my Table 15, and we're going to talk about that. But I welcome him humbly. I know his background. I know his track record. I know his career. Sir, how are you?
I am great, and you just made my day even better being here. It's always a privilege and an honor, no matter where we are, as long as we're together. And doing a show like this makes it even more special.
You know, let's just start from the beginning. You selected, of all the departments in the world, of all the levels, state, local, and federal, the New York City Police Department. Why NYPD?
My dad was an NYPD detective for 26 years, from 1950 to 1976. So that's all I knew. I knew one department in this world, and it was the NYPD. I grew up idolizing my dad and wanting to be like him, just like every little boy, you know, in the world, growing up and looking at this 6'3", 220, you know, pound Irishman who controlled his world in law enforcement and was respected like crazy. And that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted to be, just like him. I used to steal his shield when he came home from work and put it on my belt and run around and chase my sisters. So that was, you know, growing up, I was doing one of two things, Charles. I was playing baseball or I was going to be a cop. And there was no thought of anywhere else. It was going to be the NYPD and that was it. So when you have that drive of wanting to be like your dad and wanting to serve in the best police department in the world, you do it 1,000% and 100 miles an hour. And that's what I did.
Better than anybody, I'm going to tell you. But, you know, I think about your dad, too. From the 50s to the 60s, you want to talk about decades being a stark difference and then rolling into the 70s? I mean, honey, he's got some stories.
Oh, it was when I was with him and going to a Yankee game, that was a history lesson. Mm-hmm. Anytime we went into the city, whether we went to my sister's house, you know, apartment who lived on the east side, or we would go to a Yankee game, because part of the day wasn't just going to Yankee Stadium. We would stop at the 4-4 and go up to the squad. We'd go to the 4-1, Fort Apache, and go Fort up Apache. To the squad and see all his friends and his partners that he worked with, you know, and that was part of it. So that's what I mean by it was surrounding me, and it wasn't a lift. It was, yeah, we're going here, and standing in a room with a bunch of just the best there was at that time, and then driving around the streets and having him point out, all right, yeah, that happened here, that double homicide happened over here, and we chased that guy down that alleyway. It was just all the time, and talk about getting ready for a career when you were young. that's what I got, and I loved every second of it. Me and my dad, I mean, think about this. Part of, and you know this because we're from the same generation, part of your night or our night was sitting down together and watching the 6 o'clock news. That was like a TV show. It wasn't the news. It was like, okay, it's 6 o'clock. Let's see what's going on in the world. And we would sit there, and if there was a story about a homicide that was on the news, I would talk to him about it. Like, hey, how would you do this? How would you do that? Where would you start? Who would you talk to? And that was the conversation during the news we would have if there was a story that was a crime story. And that's what I was so interested in, you know, growing up. And it just led to what I became.
And you know, the world is a small place sometimes. And I interviewed somebody on Zone 7, Detective Ralph. Remember who I'm talking about?
Yes.
And it was so incredible because you texted me and said, hey, do you have a phone number for him? I think he knew my dad. Will you tell us just a little bit about that when you reconnected with him?
Yeah, I'd known about Ralph last year, and then just schedules and life kind of gets in the way of getting in touch with him. And I lost touch with him, and I actually don't know what happened to his contact that I had. And then I saw that you had him on and reached right out to him. He remembered me. And I actually had the opportunity to go to his house and see all the medals and everything he had. And he's the most decorated NYPD detective in its history. I mean, a man is an absolute walking legend. But even better was talking to him about stories I knew and I had heard from my dad. And they actually worked in the 4-1 and Fort Apache at the same time. He vaguely remembered my dad, showed him a couple of pictures of him, and he did. So, you know, like you said, big world, but small world, especially in our world, which shrinks tremendously when we start talking and throwing names around. It doesn't matter where you are on this coast or the West Coast. If you talk enough to a cop, you're going to find someone in common that you have.
Yes, yes. And I just thought that reunion was amazing. And the pictures of the two of y'all in his house with all of those medals and plaques and commendations, it was just, it got to me because I know your dad would have loved that.
Oh, God, it would have been, he would have went with me. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
If I had said to him, if he was still alive and I said, hey, I'm going to see Ralph, you know, he'd be like, all right, let's go.
Love it.
There's no 100%. Way he would have let me go by myself.
Tell me your toughest night.
Oh, there was one. And it's funny you bring that up because I go down and speak in the NYPD Academy quite often, either at CIC course, which is the criminal investigation course for new detectives. And I'll go and talk to them, or once in a while I'll get to speak to the recruits and in even colleges that I go and speak at. And I tell them about this one night. And God's honest truth, this was the night. I'm going to try to remember it. My partner and I, we were in uniform, and we start off the night assisting narcotics, who was chasing this guy down the street. So we get in a foot pursuit into a park, roll around in the park, lock him up, rip my shirt, have to go back to the precinct and get a new shirt. Later on that night, four people get shot on the corner of 149 and Broadway. Have to assist, you know, them and go to that scene, and anti-crime ended locking the guy up who did the shooting. So we're assisting running around with that with four people shot. A little time later, a 16-year-old girl wanted to jump off a 20-story building, and me and my partner got up to the roof in time, grabbed her, flipped her back over the fence, and got her out of that situation. A couple of hours later, we get a call of an 8-day-old baby that's not breathing. We run up to the apartment, grab the baby that is totally unresponsive and not breathing, run down the stairs, jump in the car. I'm driving. My partner has the baby on his lap. We're doing 100 miles an hour up Riverside Drive to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, and the other cops in my command and the Northern Command and the 3-4 are shutting the streets down as we're going. We're doing CPR in the front seat of the car on an 8-day-old baby, and get to the emergency room and kind of slide sideways, you know, into the emergency port. And as soon as we did that, the baby started crying. And then about an hour or two later, we get a call that there's a cop shot in the 4-4 precinct, which is in the Bronx. And they're coming over to Columbia Press because just in the area of the Bronx they were, it was the closest hospital in Manhattan. And they're flying over there. We're flying up to the hospital to start shutting some streets down or whatever. And they pull into the emergency room we were just at with a great event that happened a couple of hours earlier, saving a baby. And now we have a cop that shot pulling into the same area. and get in the back seat and get him out of the car and up on a stretcher and into the emergency room, and unfortunately ended up dying from multiple gunshot wounds. That was one night. That was one 4-12 tour that I won't forget. And it's 32 years ago. And I just rattled it off the way I did because that's the kind of night that was.
It's burned in that memory. How about your most memorable arrest?
Oof. Most memorable arrest was probably the shooting we were in. I was involved in a shooting in 1993, a month after I got married. So Ange loved that.
She is so lovely, and she is so supportive, and she is just, I mean, I don't have enough wonderful things to say about her, but the timing of that.
Yeah, a month. Literally, it ended up, by the time we got back from our honeymoon, it was probably, about 2 or 3 weeks later. We get in a shooting with three individuals who robbed the supermarket. One of the cops I was with got shot during the exchange of gunfire. He got shot in the leg. He was okay. He survived, but ended up getting off the job. But we have this shooting with three individuals. Ralph was at my wedding, the cop who got shot. My partner, who I was with that day, was at my wedding. So we were all friends, not just, you know, partners working. And we ended up getting all three of them. We shot two of them. We end up arresting all three, and all three did about 100 years in jail. They're still in jail, which is the best part. But that was, you know, it was personal because of obviously them trying to kill us and them shooting Ralph. So that was probably the one that certainly stands out.
Now, you've already mentioned being in shootouts in different situations that were clearly dangerous, being on bridges. What was the most dangerous situation in your 35 years?
Probably when I went to Afghanistan for 3 months as part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. We were sent over there on a kidnapping case, and there were numerous things that we ran into over there. Unfortunately, can't get into the specifics of them, but think about just being an NYPD cop and dealing with New York City or the Bronx or Brooklyn, wherever you might be, and now being in the middle of a war zone and playing by their rules, which there aren't any. So having to deal with that and got out of, you know, a couple of tough situations that we were in. And the reason for getting out of them was not being, you know, tough or anything. It was pure experience in not panicking and not overreacting to one or two things and having a great partner at the time and keeping our heads on and just, you know, methodically kind of working with each other to get out of a couple of tough situations. But that was probably, even afterwards, Cheryl, my partner, after getting out of one situation, looks at me and yells, "Hey, I guess we're not in the Bronx anymore."
And so, hey, y'all, it wasn't like y'all were working in, you know, Disneyland.
No, I mean,
y'all had a pretty rough environment y'all were working in every day.
Yeah, every day, every single day. And when you got back to the embassy compound, you know, you took a deep breath that you got back, and you were thankful for it because it was, you know, if you were the passenger in the car driving around, that was your job. You had to watch everyone walking, every car driving, every double parked car, every, you know, everything going on around you because the driver was just driving. So it was very stressful being out on the street when you had to go and do wherever, or you had to drive up to Bagram or wherever we had to go. So when the day was done, you were very thankful you were back home.
When you sign up for the NYPD at 18, 19, 20, 21, Afghanistan is not crossing your mind. And I bet you there's a lot of people listening right now that don't even realize that a police officer is going to be sent to a war zone on a kidnapping case.
Right. And that's kind of, that was the family. You know, here's the tough part, Cheryl. During the time, you know, we're bound by, you know, classification and top secret clearances and all that when we're working. So think about this, to even add more to that. My family knew I was going to Afghanistan, but had no idea why, because I couldn't tell them why. I mean, think about that. You know, thinking of their stress level of, you know, dad and your husband's going to a war zone and you're an NYPD detective. First of all, why?
Why?
Comes up.
Yep.
And then not being able to explain it. And then staying there for 3 months, not a week, not a few days, 3 months of not knowing why I was there. So, you know, there's things that happen in a career. And I tell, you know, I just mentioned being at the CIC course. When I go there and talk to young detectives, I tell them, and it happened to me, you have to be prepared for your entire world and career changing in 1 minute. And that happened to me. You know, I would have been absolutely the happiest detective in New York City if I ended up on a homicide squad in the Bronx. That was my goal. That's where I wanted to be. That was it. That was the top of the line that I thought in the NYPD. And then 9/11 happens, and 102 minutes later, I'm assigned to the terrorism task force and around the world. So that's what I tell them. You know, it's great to have a plan, but you have to be ready to adapt to something else because the world is what it is today.
And, you know, you go home and you're literally packing and you tell Angie, hey, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to be gone. I can't tell you what I'm doing. I can't tell you exactly. I can tell you Afghanistan, but I can't tell you exactly anything else. You know, see ya. and she just has to be smiling and supportive. I'm going to tell you right now, if I did not have the job that I have and did not have the understanding that I do, I wish Walt McCollum would walk in here and tell me, hey, I'm packing. I got to go and I can't tell you where, I can't tell you with who, and I can't tell you for how long. You ain't going to make it to the door, sugar.
Right.
I'm telling you.
Right.
So it takes a, to me, she deserves part of your award.
Oh, God. And I said it that night. You were
you
there.
Did.
I
you did. You did it. And you know, said it beautifully. And it was true, though.
It was true. Because, you know, spouses don't get enough credit militarily and in law enforcement or first responders as much as they should, because we know what we're doing. We know where we're at. We know the situations we're in, and we're trained to handle them. They're sitting X amount of miles away, not knowing where we are. And to do that, I mean, think of, you know, my wife, think about that for 30 years, not a couple of weeks, 30 years of that thought in your head of, God, I really hope you come home tonight, you know, and living with that. And then not just taking care of yourself, but then taking care of three kids on top of that.
Well, I will say this publicly again. For the rookies that are listening, for the young people going into this career, pick your partner. Take some time. I'm just telling you, it will make all the difference in your life. I mean, Tom, you had an impossible job to go to a war zone when you had not been in the military.
Correct.
And Angie could have been crying and carrying on and throwing stuff and having a fit, and the kids could be all out of control, and that would have made your job impossible, but that's not what you had at home. And I just want people to hear that, because if you've got somebody that's jealous, if you've got somebody that doesn't have your back, if you're with somebody that doesn't really want the best for you, you might want to think about that relationship.
Yeah. It's, you know, I say it all the time, and me and you have had this discussion, not only, you know, the night of the induction, but, you know, after that I'm lucky, you know, I'm one of the fortunate ones, because so many, marriages don't work and so many things go wrong in relationships with police officers. And I'm one of the lucky ones to be with the same woman for 35 years is not the norm. And that's sad to say, you know, that's, and I've said it so many times, I hate the reaction I get when I'm out somewhere speaking and I say, you know, I've been with the same woman for 35 years and people look at me, oh my God, really? And that shouldn't be. And that's sad that, that that's the reaction, but it's the reality of it.
Especially in our world, most of the people we know are on their second or third marriage.
Yes, absolutely.
So again, take your time picking.
Take your time.
Speaking of good partners, tell us about being paired up with somebody and you're working 12 hours, if not more, in a car.
It is one of the most important decisions you can make in the NYPD. And, you know, this goes back, and it's just a funny story, but this goes back to watching my dad and watching him with his partners. I mean, I still, to this day, speak to quite often, and Joe actually just passed away a couple of years ago, one of my dad's partners and his family. That's from 50 some odd, 60 years ago that they worked together. And I still am in touch with his entire family. And that's how, that's what I grew up watching of what partners were like and the relationship of families and not just, you know, partners in the job, but family relationships and them coming down to our house down the Jersey Shore. And like I said, this day, still reaching out to them and seeing how they're doing, what's going on, how are things, all that. And that's what I grew up watching. So that, and here's the funny part of it. As silly as it's going to sound, my favorite TV show growing up was Starsky and Hutch.
And part that's a of, good one.
Part Heck of yeah. Star, right. Part of Starsky and Hutch was them as partners and the way they were together. And I, as a young kid going, I want that. That's the partner I want. And took that into the job. And I was lucky as anything to have some of the most reliable, smart, tactical friends that were partners. And each of them had a different role in my career. You know, when I was on patrol, George Figueroa was my partner. And we were, I mean, we did it right. We knew each other. We had codes for certain things and
yes,
keywords
Lord.
For, you know,
yes.
You know, and one of them got us out of a bad situation one night. If you want to hear just real quick, we pull a car over and we had a deal. We had a system that if we called each other by a different name, something was wrong. And we pulled the car over one night on St. Nicholas Avenue, right off of 145th Street. And I'm at the driver window and Figgy's at the passenger window. He didn't have a passenger, solo driver. And I'm looking around, I'm talking to him, and Fig goes, "Hey, Mikey, you okay?" I go, "Yep, I'm all good." And with that, didn't even ask, opened the door, grabbed the guy out of the car, pulled him out of the car, cuffed him on St. Nicholas Avenue, right, you know, in the middle of the street. Cuff him on, like, "What's up?" And he goes in the back seat and pulls a shotgun out of under the seat of the driver's side seat. He saw the barrel sticking out, grabbed it. We end up running him, and he was wanted for 3 bank robberies down in North Carolina.
But it's just that trust. Like you said, you didn't question it. You didn't go, "Huh? Yeah. Oh, my gosh." Just pure action, because you know he's got you.
Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of trust. So, you know, doing that on patrol with him, and then, you know, Carlos Perez, my partner in narcotics and in the robbery squad, you know, and Carlos, I tell him all the time, you know, he's the guy who taught me how to be a detective. And just his mindset of, hey, think outside the box, don't get caught in that box. You know, let's think outside this, how we get this, how do we get that, and don't ever stop until we get the bad guys. You know, he had a saying when we were in narcotics, "Just get the bad guys, we'll figure everything else out later." And I use that my whole career. Just get the bad guys, everything else we'll figure out.
Well, there's brilliance in that. My partner, Leslie Saunders, you know, she's much older than me. She's probably going to listen to this episode. So I think she's 80, 81. But anyway.
Wow.
But, you know, that trust, that understanding, you know, we had that thing. Leslie can take anything. She can take being called anything. You can be as vulgar and as rude and as profane as you want. But if you call her stupid, we have a situation. I don't know why. I've never really known, because she's not stupid. She's one of the brightest people that I know. But something about somebody calling her that. So you know, understanding your partner, you can save that person getting in trouble. You know, you take over the person that's being, you know, loud and, you know, trying to degrade you and, you know, cuss at you, so that your partner doesn't take a swing or doesn't, you know, get caught on camera. You know, you got to have that understanding. And I always felt like part of my job wasn't just to make sure we were safe, but to make sure, you know, she looked good and, you know, we did the right thing.
Sure. And, you know, there was one time, Quig, you'll love this if I can.
Honey, it is your show. You talk about what you want.
There was one time that Carlos actually got mad at me. Relatively mad. So we're in a robbery squad. And, you know, you go back to when you ask for, your best arrest. I contemplated telling you this story, but the shooting went above it. But this one was really close. We get called into the lieutenant's office and he says, hey, you know, we got this pattern, you know, of these two shootings and these four robberies we think are connected. What do we got on it? Do we have anyone? You know, I'm due in the chief's office at 1 o'clock and he's going to rip me a new one for this thing being open. What do we have? And we're like, well, we don't have really anything, boss. All we had was a male black named Jerome with gold teeth in the Bronx. That's all we had. So being the wise ass that I was at the time, I looked at him and I go, what time's your meeting? He goes, 1 o'clock. Now it's like 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. So I go, all right, we'll have it by 1 o'clock. And he goes, get out of my office. I'm like, we'll have him by 1 o'clock. We walk out of his office. Carlos looks at me. He goes, what are you doing? I'm like, he goes, what are you, out of your mind? I go, come on, let's go. He goes, Tom, we have Jerome in the Bronx. I'm like, yeah, I know. Let's go. So we go out. And he's looking at me like, I mean, he literally wanted to knock my head off because I did this. So I go, come on, let's go. We go out. He's like, where are we going? He said, let's go to the first location of the shooting up on the Grand Concourse. Walking across the street towards the building, and this kid's walking across towards us. And he kind of looks at us a little funny. So I stop. I said, listen, if he turns around, we're going to go grab and talk to him. So the kid turns around, looks at us. We run back across the street. We grab him like, hey, what's going on? And they start asking about the shooting. He goes, I don't know who did it. I don't know his name, but I know where his sister lives. Okay, where's his sister live? He gives us the address. So we go over there and we're sitting in front of, you know, on this block. We have no idea where on the street this possible sister lives. And we're sitting there and this kid's walking down the street and he's got a brown paper bag in his hand, having a drink. So Carlos is in the passenger seat, who can talk to anybody. Carlos could talk to the devil. I mean, with no issue whatsoever. And he calls him over and he starts talking to him. And I look over and the kid's not opening his mouth. So I say, Carlos, make him laugh. Just tell a joke, make him laugh. And the kid laughs. He's got gold teeth. So we get out of the car. And we're like, hey, bro, listen, you can't have an open beer. Can't, you know, everyone sees us talking to you. We got to give you a summons or something. Do you have your license? He goes, no, I don't. We're like, what's your name? He's like, you know, he comes up with this Kevin or something. So we're like, all right. Oh, Mikey. I'm sorry. He said Michael. He says, Michael's my name. We're like, all right, listen, where's your license? It's up in my sister's apartment. Okay. Let's go upstairs to your sister's apartment and get your license. We go inside. He opens the door and he goes, hey, the police are here. They're going to give me a summons for an open container. The sister yells out, Jerome, why are you always getting in trouble? We grab him, throw him in the hallway, get him on the ground, cuff him, go back to the precinct, 12:45.
Tom Smith.
12:45. We get to the office. I call the chief's office and I ask for the lieutenant. He's like, what do you want? I said, we got him. He goes, what? I go, we got him. I said, you want us to deliver him to you? Or you want to come see him? He goes, I'll be right there. He walked in and couldn't believe it.
Yeah, that's why you're a legend right there. So let's talk about when you got the call about the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, we had nominated Kimber Gist to be in the Hall of Fame, who is, oh my God. I mean, if she didn't get in the Hall of Fame, there shouldn't be a Hall of Fame, basically. That's why someone like her, who got shot 8 times and survived, is why the Hall of Fame was developed. So we had nominated her right after we interviewed her on the show. And one morning I'm here and Adam, Megan, and Danny FaceTime me. And that wasn't unusual. We had talked before, about whatever trip coming up or whatever it might have been. So them calling on a FaceTime wasn't unusual. So Megan starts going, hey, I just want to let you know, Kimber got in. So I'm like, oh my God, you just made my year. You just made everything. I'm happy as hell. Great. I'm thinking about Kimber. And while I'm thinking about Kimber, Megan says my name. And I go, why'd you just say my name? And so Megan goes, did you hear anything I just said to you for the last like 40 seconds? I'm like, no. What'd you say? And she's like, then I look at her. I'm like, why are you crying?
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, yeah. You. And then she told me that I got in and I was getting a Lifetime Achievement Award. And I just went, wait, what? Like, what are you talking about? I'm happy for Kimber. We're talking about her. She's like, no, you got. And then she starts telling me that I'm going to be inducted. It took about 10 seconds and I had to hang up. And I'm like, listen, I got to call you guys back. Because 30 years of emotions and what you did and how you did it all came rushing into my head in one shot. And it was an extremely proud moment. And obviously the first person I think of was my dad, wishing he was still here, that I could have called him and told him that, and everything he instilled in me and taught me, and how do you do this and why you're doing it? All that came out. So you can imagine, what I was feeling at that time, and then having the opportunity to tell my family. And then about an hour later, I got to call them back and thank them. But it was, something so incredibly unexpected, because we don't, and I said it that night, Cheryl, we don't go into this job to get things like this. We don't. It's not on a checklist. It's not on a to-do list. I want to be a cop and get into National Law Enforcement Officers Hall of Fame. That's not even thought about. And that's not why we get into law enforcement. So when you're thought of like that and able to be inducted into such an organization like this, it's a tremendous honor that I just cherish all the time.
Let's talk a little bit about Table 15.
Yes.
Because for most people, this type of night is elegant, it's formal, it's beautiful, it's a once in a lifetime. It's probably just the pinnacle of your career. I mean, there is nothing any higher, right? But not our table, honey.
Well, you made sure of that. Because, and you were right in saying it. Listen, there's too much seriousness that goes into our job and our profession. Because most of the time we have to be a certain way and carry ourselves a certain way. But when you have the opportunity to just enjoy something with every breath you have, and we laughed and joked and cried and had the best time. You know, when you have, you know, 25 tables staring at us and looking over at us because we're laughing so much during the night.
That's the cool kids table. Thank you. Listen, we had Kimber and her mom.
Chicken nuggets and the french fries.
We had Kimber and her mom, you and your lovely bride, Dan and his lovely bride, and Walt and I. And let me tell you, we laughed a lot, but I want everybody to hear me when I tell y'all, when Dan Murphy turns and says, "You want to know the best practical joke I ever pulled? The night is going to take a turn." Okay. And then Kimber follows up with hers. And then Tom Smith says, "Well, this may or may not have happened." Well, at that point, I just thought, man, if this table had a recording.
Oh, it would be its own show.
It could be its own show. And everything we talked about was true. Every story I told, every story y'all told, absolutely true. But honey, it would probably get us in a little bit of trouble with some folks.
Oh my God. It was, you know, from practical jokes to, you know, situations we were all in on the street and things we did. It was a special night to begin with, but then it was just extra. It was just extra innings of a ball game, of what it was. And we deserve that. You know, I say this all the time, Sean, you do too, that it's okay for cops to feel that they deserve something, you know, a good night like that. It's okay to feel that and to understand that and to cherish those because we don't get a lot of them. You know, and when we do, we have to enjoy it because we just go through way too much that 99% of the people in this country would never even think of doing. And when you have a chance to just laugh and joke around with people who are now part of your family and love and respect, it makes that night so much more special. And Table 15 is going to pop up again in April of 2026, for sure.
For sure. And I'll tell you, you know, what they've done with this Hall of Fame, you said it that night, and it is the truth. It is a family.
It is. It's just, and it's a special family because of what it represents. It's these stories and these situations that people go through and get acknowledged. And Megan and Adam do God's work because without them, no one knows about these stories. No one knows about Kimber Giss, who got shot 8 times, you know, and survived. You know, no one knows those stories of others who won awards that night, the K-9 awards, all those. And it gives everyone an opportunity to not just hear the stories, but see the people who lived through them. And that's even more of an impact when these people are standing up on a stage and telling the story of their induction. And they're real. They're flesh and blood. They're humans. They cry. They fail. And it all comes to a head that night thanks to Megan and Adam's hard work throughout a year. I mean, they start 2025 happened in March. Megan started 2026 the following week.
Right. And let me just tell you, Megan and Adam both, they live it. They feel it. They believe in it. They cry. They feel every inductee and want to make sure that they are honored in a way that their families are going to be proud of. This isn't just a, hey, congratulations, you know, you did a great job this one night. That's not it. All year long, they reach out. All year long, they're like, hey, everything good? Happy birthday. Happy anniversary. Make sure you've already blocked out the date for April. Like, they want this family to come back together year after year.
Yeah, no doubt. That's a great point because the night is put together for all the families and the pop and circumstance and the stuff on tables and the speakers and the extra things that they have going on before the induction night, the ceremony, is all for families because Megan and Adam understand that law enforcement is not a singular entity. It's a family that goes through every single thing that that cop goes through. The heartache, the pain, the failures, the injuries, all of that is a family thing. And they understand that. And that's why those nights are special.
And, you know, Tom and I started a tradition, sort of sub-level. Not everybody knows about it, but it's something that's going to continue. And it's one of those things, it's almost like a secret code. And that means the world to me. So I cannot wait for this April to watch you continue the tradition, sir.
Yes. And the only reason, and just to let you know, we didn't do it last year because I wasn't going to do it without you being there. So, you know, that's why it wasn't done last year. So we're both going to be there this year to continue that. And, you know, that's I get through a speech that was, you know, emotional and I got through it. And then you throw your part in. I was like, really? You know, I got through this and now you're going to throw this at me. But it was, and it's still where I put it that night. And it's going to be removed in April and it's going to be in someone else's hands. So I can't wait for that.
Love it. Well, Tom Smith, I love you. I adore you. I respect you. I am so proud that you were the first guest for the National Law Enforcement Hall of Fame highlight on Zone 7.
Well, I couldn't be more honored, and you know how I feel about you. Talk about clicking with someone and just an immediate connection was what me and you were and continue to be. You know, for everyone listening to this, we talk at least once a week just to say hi, because the respect level of our industry can get mired in nonsense a lot. And when you fall in love with true people who just have a admiration and respect for, it makes life so much better. And you go through heartaches in this job and a lot of bad stuff, but then when you get to where we are now, it's all worth it because you're in my family and I love you dearly and everything you do. And to have you be part of my life is a blessing.
I'm Cheryl McCollum, and this is Zone 7.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.